in a world where there's never enough to eat, in a world where you are dependent on the kindness of those around you, he feels no envy and desires nothing from, he does not covet his neighbor's parcel. And it's a small thing, but it's an enormous thing. It is a basic decency that cannot be crushed out of some men. And in the midst of the horror and the darkness, in the midst of the torment and the suffering, we get tiny little glimpses of human decency and human dignity. Not just man at his worst, but man at his best. Like those stars shining in the dark sky. And in this way, we begin to get a sense of who this man is, how he's lived, how he functions. And he may never, in the course of the novel, stand up and commit a heroic action, but Solzhenitsyn is making the point that to live in these conditions, to have been through what he has been through, to suffer what he has suffered, to have a belly as empty as his belly and not envy, may be heroism of a kind that the rest of us can't understand. And maybe, that small triumph of the good can have enormous consequences. I'll come back to that later. This basic decency and basic dignity of man is everywhere in the novel. It is, simply put, what the Soviets couldn't stamp out. Try as they might, they couldn't finally destroy that which was good and those little flashes of nobility that still exist. Solzhenitsyn said, it's in the Gulag, you love life, you think life is wonderful, that's great, then love it in the camps. Because that's life too. And whatever is going out in the world at large, you will find reflected here in miniature. We may be behind barbed wire, we may be behind walls, there may be no food, we may be freezing to death, people may be dying around us, but this is life. And in this life, you will find the full array of everything you find in humanity. Because whatever the system, the nature of man doesn't change. And the mystery is not the economic political theory or the totalitarian government. The mystery is the mystery of man. And you can discover the extreme range of that mystery just as much in an average slave labor camp as you can anywhere else in the world. And therefore, that's what he examines. Let's look at one of the paradoxes here. What is the center of the communist vision? It's work. He who does not work does not eat. Okay? Unless you happen to be one of the bureaucrats high up, but they don't say that. If you don't work, you don't eat. And therefore, in the camps, everybody goes out to work. And we also learn from this that there are different kinds of work at different camps. Ivan Denisovich remembers back to an earlier camp he was in where they got them up early in the morning and they would go logging. And they stayed out in the woods and they logged till they met their quota. There was no stopping point. And he talks about, boy, this is really cushy here because there comes the moment in the day and the bell rings and that's it, we're done. And we get to go back. Once we go through the bureaucratic lineups to make sure no one's escaped and count it again, okay? they still are treated like robots, okay? Or animals. But nevertheless, the workday ends at one point. They all go out to work. What are they working on? The fear is they're going to be sent to one of the new projects where there's no cover, there are no barriers, and they're going to be out in the real cold and the real wind all day long. And one reason this is a good day, they don't get sent there. Some other poor slobs get sent there. They get sent to another place where they have a few moments at the beginning of the day to warm themselves. One could go through this whole novel and just look at the attempts to get warm. And in that sense, we're talking about survival. They have a few moments where they gather around that stove. Then they're back out at it, and what are they building? They are building a wall for the new power plant. What is that power plant going to power? It's going to power the camp in which they are prisoners. And the cruel irony is, you would think what they would do would be to do the shoddiest work possible in order to have the power plant fall down. Especially since no matter how hard they work or how accomplished their job is at the end of the day, they're going to be cheated on their reward. They're not going to get what they were promised. Therefore, we would assume they'll do lousy work. They won't care. They'll build it so it'll fall down. What do we find? They are dedicated workers. They join together, and as they put up that wall, their gang becomes a group of men who may be building a power plant to fuel the prison in which they are prisoners, but they are men, and man works, and a real man takes pride in his work. And there is more dignity in their building the wall of the power plant than in the entire Soviet bureaucracy. Because they care and do good work. And they do good work because they must rely on each other. They are proud of each other. They work with each other. And they do a good job. So we get that incredibly ironic scene where after Ivan Denisovich has said, well, boy, it's better here because the end of the day comes and the work stops. And what does he do when the end of the day comes? He keeps building. He keeps building because if he doesn't, by the next morning that mortar will have hardened. He won't be able to work with it. He's got to complete the last few rows of bricks. And instead of saying, well, that's it, I'm done, I'm out of here, okay, the bell, now I'm going, A man taking pride in his work and a job well done and seeing it well done, and what is he building? The power plant at the prison where he is a prisoner. There's another extraordinary example of this that comes right near the end, where the captain is hauled off. And when the captain goes to the prison for something he'd done that morning, where he mouths off, early in the morning he mouths off and criticizes the Soviet government. You don't know Article 9 of the Criminal Code. Okay, you have no right to make people undress in freezing cold. That's the code. You may not do that. But they did have. They did know. It's you, brother, who don't know anything. Why? Because there is no code. What is the code? Whatever they say it is at any given moment. Why? Because there's no truth. Why is there no truth? Because there's no God. Why is there no God? Because these men have tried to replace him. There is only man. And we are going to redo the world better than God did it. It's you, brother, who don't know anything. The captain kept blazing away at them. You aren't real Soviet people. Volkovoy didn't mind Article 9, but at this he looked as black as a thundercloud. 10-day strict regimen, he shouted. Starting this evening, he told the head warder, lowering his voice. They never like putting a man in the hole first thing in the morning. It means the loss of one man shift. Let him sweat and strain all day and sling him in the hole at night. And that's what happens. The end of the day, he comes back. He's back in the hut with the others, and in they come for him. They don't forget. They never forget. In they come for him, and they take him off. Keep smiling. Don't let him get you down. But there was nothing much you could say. Gang 104 had built the punishment block themselves and knew all about it. The walls were stone, the floor cement. There were no windows at all. The stove was kept just warm enough for the ice on the wall to melt and form puddles on the ground. You slept on bare boards, got 300 grams of bread a day, skilly only every third day. 10 days, 10 days in that cell block, if they were strict about it and made you sit out the whole stint, meant your health was ruined for life. It meant tuberculosis and the rest of your days in the hospital. 15 days in there, and you'd be 6 feet under. Thank heaven for your cozy hut, and keep your nose clean. Whew. They built it, and they built it well. And now off goes one of them. Why did they build it well? Pride in their work. Pride in their work. They are men. They have human dignity. I could go through this, you know, I could keep, it just continues, everywhere, everywhere. Theory, reality. contradictions that make no sense. Other than there is something higher. There is something higher than just the work, just the system, just the prison. And that higher thing gets expressed through the novel as well. Some examples. They talk about the same things that men always talk about. They have political discussions. Throughout the book, they are talking politics. It happens over and over again. You'll get them together, and suddenly they'll come out with something, okay? And they'll tell stories. They'll share stories back and forth. I've got to rush through some of this. I'm way behind already. I apologize. Let me just give one quick example. Talking about things that have happened overseas in different countries. And then suddenly it's late at night again, and somebody in the room was bellowing, "Old man Whiskers won't ever let you go. He wouldn't trust his own brother, let alone a bunch of cretins like you." Old man Whiskers is Papa Joe. That's the big man. And suddenly we get not just a political discussion, but open revolution. Remember that what got Solzhenitsyn sent to the camps in the first place was he was critical of Stalin in a letter. Boom, sentence, 8 years in the camps. And now suddenly in the camps we're having open political attacks on the leader. How can they get away with it? What are they going to do, sentence him to a camp? And suddenly we realize the only place in the country where there can be free and open political discussion is in the camps. And it gets, the good thing about hard labor camps is that you have all the freedom in the world to sound off. In Ust Izhma, you'd only have to whisper that people couldn't buy matches outside and they'd clap another 10 on you. Here, you could shout anything you like from a top bunk and the stoolies wouldn't report it because the security officer couldn't care less. All of a sudden we get, you can imagine how the people reading this roared with laughter at that moment. There is free speech in the Soviet Union, in the camps. As soon as you get sent there, you can say whatever you want. Don't tell us. Yeah, we have freedom of political speech. Come, let me show you that it is. 10 years. It's riotously funny. And, of course, it's not funny at all. But they're very aware of politics. They're talking about politics. What else are they talking about? Art. Talking about art, poetry, music, it happens over and over. It's a wonderful moment. This is very early on. Shukov, who's not terribly bright, okay, he's not the brightest fellow in the world. he's been sent off to wash the floor in one of the officers' huts, and he had the old wag's habit of letting his eyes wander where they shouldn't, and he noticed that Kolya was writing lines of exactly the same length, leaving a margin, and starting each one with a capital letter exactly below the beginning of the last. He knew right off, of course, that this wasn't work, but something on the side. None of his business, though. Kolya's writing poetry. He's writing poetry. Shukov hasn't read poetry. He doesn't recognize it. Just look what he's doing. This is weird. The line is this long, then he stops and he leaves a margin and goes back and starts the next one with a capital letter right under the last one. Wonder what that is. Oh, well. You can't stamp out art. You cannot stamp out the creative urge. You may be in the midst of this horror, and what's this man doing? He's writing poetry. We don't get to read it. We never know what it is. We have flashes of characters, glimpses of actions that are never explained. Because there is a distance, even among these men, we get little bits of their story. We get hints or guesses as to how they got there or where they came from. We never get the full story. Any more than we get the full story of Ivan Denisovich. We get little fragments of his story along the way. But again, that was Solzhenitsyn's experience. You're there, you meet someone, you learn something, and before you know it, you're off again. You meet other people, get a bit of their story, you're off again, or they're off. And yet, in the midst of this, what happens? They're writing poetry. As he did, as I said last night. Art surfaces in the most unlikely places. What came out of the camps? A very great novel. Something that the Soviet system certainly did not expect. Another example. This is very nice. We get an ongoing debate that continues over time about movies. I mean, this is what they're talking about, movies. They're in the camps. They're living in primitive conditions. "You're wrong, old man," Cesar was saying good-naturedly. "Objectively, you will have to admit this Eisenstein is a genius. Surely you can't deny that Ivan the Terrible is a work of genius. The dance of the master Oprenichki, the scene in the cathedral." KH123's spoon, notice how he's identified, just by his number. KH123's spoon stops short of his mouth. Now, what's the thing they want most? What do they dream about? What do they talk about? Food. "We've got a spoonful of food going to his mouth." It stops. "Bogus," he said angrily. "So much art in it that it ceases to be art. Pepper and poppy seed instead of good, honest bread. And the political motive behind it is utterly loathsome. An attempt to justify a tyrannical individual. An insult to the memory of three generations of the Russian intelligentsia." He was eating his gruel without savoring it. It wouldn't do him any good. And they keep arguing about the movies. Why? Because art matters. Because art is central to human existence. You can't crush it out. They're talking about the movies of Eisenstein in the camps. It's wonderful because it pops up again later. Pages and pages later, suddenly we're hearing they're still arguing. It's hours later. The pince-nez dangling from the rigging, for instance, yes. Or the baby carriage rolling down the, yes, but in that film, life on board ship is like a puppet. They're still going at it. Hours later. Getting through their day how? Arguing about something that matters. Why? Because art elevates the soul. The gruel doesn't matter. The work doesn't matter at that moment. The coal doesn't matter. Why are they talking about the cinema? Because it's important. And for a small moment, they are elevated above where they are and are in touch with something good and true and eternal, even if it means just arguing about that movie. In the same way, for the Soviet citizenry, for one instant in 1962, they were elevated above the cold, gray, dead horror of life, and everyone was talking about one book, one novel. And it was not just the realism. I am now adding to my earlier point. It was not just the realism. It was the elevation of soul. And great art elevates the soul. Now, this is not an entertaining novel. As I keep insisting over and over again, art has two functions, to entertain and to instruct. And some works are much more entertainment, and others are much more instructional, and this is hard instruction. We have a few smiles in here, a couple of chuckles, but there isn't a lot of humor in this book. This is instructional to let the people know what was going on, but as it does that, it is still art because it elevates. And as those people read this novel, they were elevated. And if we can break through into an understanding of what it is he's presenting here, beyond one situation, but indeed, as with the greatest art, if you tell the complete truth about one moment in time in one location, you're going to break through time into an eternal truth. That's what he does here in this novel. Therefore, we should not be surprised that one of the central topics in the book is religion. They tried to stamp it out. It was forbidden. You don't worship, you don't believe, you don't talk about it, you're good communists, you know there's no God. And right from the beginning of the day, right from the start, one of the first things we get is we meet Shukov's neighbor, Alyoshka, the well-washed Baptist. They may be in the camps, but he keeps himself clean. Why? Because he's a good Baptist, and we know that cleanliness is next to godliness. And I mean, it's a wonderful little moment. The well-washed Baptist who was reading the notebook into which he had copied half the New Testament. It's just, you can't keep the scriptures out of the camps. They're there. They may be handwritten. They may be passed from hand to hand. But then remember, that's the way they were passed originally. And if that's what we're back to, then so be it. They're there. they get in, and they're being passed around. The Baptist was reading his Bible, not altogether silently, but sort of sighing out the words. This was meant, perhaps, for Shukov. A bit like political agitators, these Baptists loved spreading the word. It's a wonderful touch. And then we hear what it is he's reading, directing to his neighbor, okay? And what we're going to learn in the course of the day is they have an ongoing religious debate. All day long, and probably not just this day, but day after day after day after day. They're arguing about what? Religious matters. I'm sorry, I thought that was finished. I was done with. We declared there's none of it. Right, like you tried to block out the stars in the sky. You can't do it. You can cement their mouths shut and they will talk about God with their fingers. You cannot stop men from talking about the ultimate truths. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or a wrongdoer or a mischief maker. Yet if one suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but under that name, let him glorify God. Alyoshka was a champion at one thing, wiggling that little book of his into a crack in the wall so neatly that it had never been found by searching warders. It's hidden away in that crack in the wall. And when he wants to, out it comes. And when it comes out and he reads it, what do we hear? But if one suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but under that name, let him glorify God. And that's at the beginning of the day. And Shukov just sort of ignores it and goes, you know, he's at it. He's just always reading that thing, okay? But this continues. It continues throughout the whole day. The book is peppered with it, absolutely peppered with it. And we get glimpses of what this believer is like. We're at the worksite. Shukov looks. Alyoshka's cheeks were hollow. He lived on his bare ration and never made anything on the side. What had he got to be so happy about? He's smiling. He and the other Baptists spent their Sundays whispering to each other. Life in the camp was like water off a duck's back to them. They'd been lumbered with 25 years of peace just for being Baptists. Fancy thinking that would cure them. The government thought that 25 years in a prison camp would stop them from believing? The government doesn't know Baptists. And they're in there, and they are living out something that they believe. Unlike, please notice, the Soviet officials who will not live out their communist beliefs. The communists are lousy communists, according to their own faith. They fail consistently to live up to it. The Baptists are great Baptists, to the point where others in the camp are astonished at what they're able to do. But they're not the only one there. Pavlo, the tough guy, he's having his dinner in the middle of the day. Tantalized him a bit longer while he finished his gruel, licked his spoon clean, but not the bowl. You never lick the bowl. It's part of that human dignity. I'll come back to that. You never lick the bowl. Put it away safely and crossed himself. And on the book goes. Tough guy, hard worker. There's something going on there. We don't find out what it is. We're not told. But we see it. It's there. And it is different from the Baptist. But it's there. And that's why the arguments go on. Because these questions matter. And they will fight about them. They will argue over them. Shukov. He's hiding that piece of metal in his mittens. He wants to get it back into the hut. He can do wonders. It's a tiny little piece of scrap metal. But who knows what it could be? A squeeze on the other mitten, he'd be done. They're checking. Squeeze on the other mitten, he'd be done for. He imagined himself getting weaker and weaker for hunger, being thrown in the hole, thought how hard it would be to get back to his present wiry, not too well-fed, but not starving condition, and he offered up a silent, agonized prayer, "Save me, Lord, don't let them put me in the hole." He gets through and runs off, forgetting to say another prayer of gratitude this time, because he was too much in a hurry, and anywhere there was no point of it now. Your average man, your average man, like most men, "Help me, Lord, help me." Oh, got through that one. Okay? Your average man. Solzhenitsyn will not sentimentalize his hero. As I said at the beginning, this is a real guy, okay? Now, it continues throughout. I need to wrap up a bit here. I've got a couple last things to do. Oh, it's just amazing. I knew this would happen. It's the end of the day. It's the end of the day. And Caesar gets his parcel. And it's loaded. There is sugar. There is sausage. There are biscuits. I mean, it's a gold mine. And everyone, I mean, they're sitting around. And of course, first, he shares it with the captain. Okay? This is sharing. They are genuinely, the crew is sharing with each other, and it's genuine. This is one of the few examples of real, I mean, there is no brotherhood in the system. The system, communism, designed to bring us all together and make us one, separates, drives apart. You'll remember the passage, I don't have time to look at it, but Shukov talking about no longer often writing to his own family, but having written and told them not to send him parcels because they needed it more than he did. He'd get along. Another mark of his basic decency, okay? More concern for his family than for himself, no matter how bad off he is. But no longer a sense. He says at one point he can barely remember his wife. Communism separates. You will be brothers as we tear you apart. Thrown in prison on their own, the parcel is opened and we begin sharing. It's coming from someplace other than economic theory, okay? And then the moment comes where suddenly they're called out again for roll, and if he leaves the parcel there, it's going to be gone. First ones back in the hut will carry it off. Thieves will come in while they're outside, carry it off. He's panicked, doesn't know what to do. And of course, Shukov knows. He's clever. He's bright. This is the kind of stuff he can do. The same way that he has the extra bread because he sewed it into his bed in the morning. Comes back that night and it's still there. But the meticulous care of sewing in that piece of bread, work well done, because it's work for a purpose, and he who works cleverly will eat a little more bread at night. And that's not communist theory. He helps him preserve his parcel, comes back, but again we're told he doesn't expect anything for it. Not that he wanted to earn a bit more from Caesar. He just pitied the man with all his heart. Wonderful parcel arrives. He may lose it all. Human sympathy. I will help. I don't expect anything for it, but I will help. You can't destroy that kind of decency. He gets into an argument, of course, with the Baptist again. I won't go through it. Read it over for yourselves. It's quite amusing. But Shukov does say a little prayer. Thanks be to thee, O God, another day over. He was thankful that he wasn't sleeping in the punishment cell. Here it was just about bearable. Alyoshka's reading the Testament again. There you are, Ivan Denisovich. Your soul is asking to be allowed to pray to God. Why not let it have its way? And then they go at it. They end the day arguing again about something that really matters, okay? And of course the Baptist is lecturing him. The Lord's behest was that we should pray for no earthly or transient thing except our daily bread. Give us this day our daily bread. Our ration, you mean? Shukov asked, okay. And he gets another lecture from the Baptist. And then Shukov says, well, let me tell you about our parish priest. Average man. I'll tell you why this religion stuff. I'll tell you about our parish priest. And the Baptist says, don't tell me about priests. It is absolutely typical. It's a conversation that anybody out there has, we've all been through it. But it's happening there. Why? Because it happens everywhere. Why? Because it is eternal. Why? Because it's true. Remember what the Apostle Paul says. What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of Lord Jesus. Shukov looked at the ceiling and said nothing. He no longer knew whether he wanted to be free or not. To begin with, he'd wanted it very much and counted up every evening how many days he still had to serve. Then he'd got fed up with it. And still later it had gradually dawned on him that people like himself were not allowed to go home, but were packed off into exile. And there was no knowing where the living was easier, here or there. The one thing he might want to ask God for was to let him go home. But they wouldn't let him go home. And there it is again. God and they. And they are at variance. And he may pray to God to let him go home, but they wouldn't let him go home. And then the hand reaches up, two biscuits, two lumps of sugar, one round chunk of sausage on his bed. It's a miracle. Okay, it's a miracle. He had expected nothing and gets something. Gets a lot. And then we find out he's been making slippers for everybody, maybe getting a root, but has made none for himself. Simple guy, humble guy, decent guy. They go out for another roll call. They come back in. Alyoshka was back. He had no sense at all, Alyoshka. Never earned a thing, but did favors for everybody. Here you are, Alyoshka. Shukov handed him up one biscuit. Give us this day our daily bread. And in one tiny act of selfless charity, the two biscuits that are his, the man who's complained of hunger all day long, who obsesses about two things, bread and cigarettes, gets two biscuits. Here you are, Alyoshka. Shukov handed him one biscuit. Alyoshka was all smiles. Thank you. You won't have any for yourself. Selfless concern for the giver. Eat it. If we're without it, we can always earn something. That little action overturns the whole Soviet system. It crumbles. It's going to go. Maybe it would last centuries, but it would go. Because you cannot destroy charity in the human heart. You cannot destroy that which is good, which God has placed even in a humble, simple little man. You can't do it. And then he eats his lump of sausage, and we get the description of him chewing the sausage and the juice coming out. He didn't give Alyoshka the sausage, but he shared a biscuit with him. It's extraordinary. Let me end with one huge contrast to make my point. It's a very sad scene that comes near the end. Fetyukov is a character running through all day, who compromises at every turn. The worst thing he does is he licks other people's bowls. Not just his own, but other people's bowls. And no one will have anything to do with him. At the work site, he will tilt out some of the mortar so that the barrel will be lighter. And they find it contemptible. And at the end of this day, Fetyukov passed down the hut sobbing. He was bent double. His lips were smeared with blood. He must have been beaten up again for licking out bowls. He walked past the whole team without looking at anybody, not trying to hide his tears, climbed onto the bunk and buried his face in his mattress. You felt sorry for him, really. He wouldn't see his time out. He didn't know how to look after himself. In looking after himself, he doesn't know how to look after himself. How do you look after yourself? By uniting with those whom you find yourself in the midst of. And that's how you get through. Although there are also those who are loners and have been there all along, and this may be my favorite moment in the book. He's sitting down late at night to eat, and he looks across and sees the tall old man, YU-81, no name, just letters and numbers, sit down opposite him when the place became free. Shukov knew that he belonged to Gang 64, and standing in line in the parcel room, he'd heard that 64 had been sent to Sotskorodok in place of 104. They're the gang that got sent to the miserable new site. And spent the whole day stringing up barbed wire, making themselves a compound with nowhere to get warm. Miserable day. Old man. He'd heard that this old man had been in prison time out of mind. In fact, as long as the Soviet state had existed, 1917, that all the amnesties had passed him by and that as soon as he finished one tenor, they pinned another on him. This was Shukov's chance to take a close look at him. With hunched over legs all around, he was as straight-backed as could be. He sat tall, as though he'd put something on the bench under him. That head hadn't needed a barber for ages. The life of luxury had caused all his hair to fall out. The old man's eyes didn't dart around to take in whatever was going on in the mess, but stared blindly at something over Shukov's head. He was steadily eating his thin skilly, but instead of almost dipping his head in the bowl like the rest of them, he carried his battered wooden spoon up high. He had no teeth left, upper or lower, but his bony gums chewed his bread just as well without them. His face was worn thin, but it wasn't the weak face of a burnt-out invalid. It was like dark, chiseled stone. You could tell from his big, chapped and blackened hands that in all his years inside, he'd never had a soft job as a trustee. But he refused to knuckle under. He didn't put his 300 grams on the dirty table, splashed all over like the others. He put it on a rag he washed regularly. In the same way that there are prisoners who will not eat with their caps on, this old man sits proud. No hair, no teeth, no life, nothing left but human dignity, and won't bow to his bowl but lifts the spoon to his lips and eats not off a placemat but a clean rag washed over and over and over again. You cannot get rid of charity. You cannot get rid of the eternal questions. You cannot destroy art, which elevates. You cannot in any way get rid of humanity. Try as you might. And whether it be in the camps or an American city or a jungle in Africa or in a seminary in Minnesota, you will have all types, all kinds living together in God's world, all on a pilgrimage to one end. And that is the end God has decreed, no matter what man or the state tries to do instead. And the image of that is the image of the dignity of that old man and not the beaten up, bleeding Fetyukov who won't make it. Because it is clear there is nothing the state can do to bend that old man's back. They tried. There is nothing the state can do to stop brotherhood under the name of communism. They tried. And there's nothing that the state can do to withhold God's truth expressed in art if he wishes it to get out. They tried. And they will fail and fail and fail again because there is something higher. And it is embodied not just in this novel, but in the life of this man. And as I said last night, it has come to be embodied for some mysterious purpose of God's plan in the country of Russia itself. And we need to all keep our eyes focused there because at any moment we could be swept up in its story. It is bound to happen. We need to be ready as Solzhenitsyn was. With courage to speak the truth and a willingness to suffer no matter what God sends. Thank you very much. (Clears throat)